The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, I want to get a sound check. It sounds to me like this is a pretty serious sound system, but are we okay in the back? All right, good. Just talked to my wife. She's in Minnesota right now. How you doing, honey? I'm doing great. Just following John MacArthur. No big deal. I'm fine. It's the most difficult thing I've ever done in my entire career, following John MacArthur. Yeah, no biggie. Let me open up with a word of prayer, and I'm glad to see that you guys are here. There's a couple of reasons I should question you for being here. First of all, there's a lot of other good speakers going on right now. Secondly, you all came to a talk that had the expression queer theory in the description, and you still came. So, glad you're here. My name's Bruce Satter. Let me go ahead and I'm going to open up with a word of prayer, and very eager to share with you what I have to share, and hopefully hear a little bit of feedback from you guys as well. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for an opportunity briefly to step out of the classroom and to regroup, to rethink what we've been doing and plan what we think we're going to do. And we come here because there's a lot of wisdom, there's a lot to be shared, there's a lot of mentoring and discipleship opportunities, and we pray that we can take advantage of those this week. Learn from what is here, learn from what others are doing. Be humble enough to know that no matter how many years we've been doing this, we all have room to grow. Please bless this talk. Let it be helpful to these teachers this morning. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I want to begin by letting you know about a little contest we're going to have. What you're seeing draped over the podium here is a t-shirt. I'll be using the expression MLT a lot, MLT, because that's what we call the course at Wilson Hill Academy. So Modern Literature and Thought, that's what we call it. I'm sure that a lot of you have courses that you teach, you have at your school that are probably similar to that. That's just the name that we came up with. It really is more than just a modern literature course. We actually originally called it MLTA, Modern Literature, Thought, and Apologetics. Is that what the A stood for, Bob? I'm trying to remember. We cut the A out early on. But it is a lot more than just studying books of the 20th and 21st century. But so anyway, in the MLT course, at the end of the year, we had a little contest in the class. And the students actually wanted to do this. I wish that I would have come up with this idea. But they wanted to design a t-shirt so that when we came together at graduation in San Antonio, we're an online school, by the way. So our kids are all over the world, and we come to a place near San Antonio for our graduation. Kids wanted to design a t-shirt so we could all wear t-shirts together and so forth. And so several of the students designed a t-shirt. We voted on the one that they liked the best, and this was the winner. So if you'd like to take a stab sometime later today, maybe tomorrow, Saturday morning, stop by the Wilson Hill Academy booth and see how many of these images you can connect to the books that we read in the course. And Bob's going to have to tell me what I'm at liberty to give away, but we're going to give away something really cool, right, Bob? So we'll have some Wilson Hill Academy paraphernalia, cups, mugs, water bottles, Yetis, whatever the case may be. But I thought this was a really nice design. So the trick is to see how many of them you can name. 3 years ago, my wife and I were given a gift. Really, really nice gift. Boy, one of the families in our school apparently felt like we needed a break, felt like we needed a vacation. So they live in Bermuda, they are Bermudans, and they gave us a trip to Bermuda. Full ride, all expenses paid, airfare, nice resort area to stay in there for a full week. Couldn't wait, lots of planning, lots of packing. We have 5 children, getting the children taken care of, get on the plane, fly over to this little British paradise out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. and I'm not exaggerating, the moment I stepped off the plane, I got sick. Stomach flu. Stomach flu lasted the whole week. Never left the hotel room. Laid in bed for the entire week while my wife sat out on the patio and read a book and looked at the beach. So I still have not walked on a beach in Bermuda. I'm waiting to do that. My name is Bruce Etter. I'm the Director of Student Life at Wilson Hill Academy. And if you're wondering if you're in the right place, this is the red-haired stepchild teaching modern literature in the classical school. When it comes to teaching, I can't get this thing to work, I won't use the, or I may just have to get Bob to come help me. But anyway, when it comes to teaching great books, by and large, our classical Christian schools have focused on ancient and medieval literature, right? Alongside key works from the post-Enlightenment era, I think we're doing a pretty good job, by and large, with Plato and Augustine, Austin and Orwell, a lot of our favorite authors. But by and large, I think we failed to delve more deeply into 20th and 21st century works that have greatly impacted current culture. As a result, it's my conviction that our graduates are entering universities and experiencing what I'm going to be talking about later as that dreaded deer in the headlights syndrome. And I trust that you came here today ready for an engaging discussion on the benefits of adding a dose of Joyce and Kafka and Wolfe and Faulkner and, yes, queer theory to your curriculum. So I want to begin by talking about, I hope I'm not going to have to somehow do that every single time, talking a little bit about how modern literature has been viewed in our classical schools. And so I guess just maybe to take a little bit of a poll here to give me some idea, how many of you are literature teachers, just in general? Okay, so that's just about everybody. Okay, good. So how many of you teach modern literature in some form or another? Okay, now that's very interesting. We're down to about 25% of the hands. Okay, so of those of you who raised your hands, how many of you have a course specifically on modern lit? 2, 3, maybe 3.5 people in the room. Okay, wow. So that's kind of what I thought. And I'm kind of curious to hear why is that? What's the reluctance to have a course specifically on modern lit? I'm asking for your feedback on that. How has modern lit been viewed in classical Christian education? Yeah.
The basic idea that something needs to be time tested.
Okay.
And proven for the years for us to feel like we're comfortable
teaching it. Fair enough. Okay, I don't know if you guys heard that in the back. That's a great point. We don't even know if these books are classics yet, right? They were just written either in this century or in the last century. So we're still feeling our way the issue of whether or not these works are time-tested. Or even a course on modern works is time-tested. There was another hand over here. I thought I saw another hand over here. Okay, anybody else? I wrote down a few thoughts. Number one, doesn't fit the classical Christian education model, whatever that model is, whatever the person who says, I don't know, I don't think that we really want to have a course on this, doesn't fit the model. Secondly, these are things that are really better left for a freshman / sophomore or beyond year in college. It's not really a high school course. We do lean very heavily on Greco-Roman literature. I've taught ancient literature myself for many, many years, and rightly so. We also have a strong emphasis on the growth of the church and medieval literature and medieval theologians. One of the reasons I thought about giving this talk is just looking at the titles of talks over the last several years at ACCS, and I haven't seen any talks on things like teaching Kafka or teaching Joyce or, you know, why we need to read William Faulkner, those kinds of things. So maybe we do need to take a fresh look at what we're missing and consider not only the value of having a course in modern lit, but also I'm gonna make a case for how it does actually fit within a classical and Christian education model. So I've got 3 points. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about preparing students for a 21st century college experience. What does that mean? Secondly, I want to talk about how the works that we have been focusing on a lot, medieval works, but I'm going to focus a little bit more on ancient literature and the connection between modern lit and the classical world. It's really astounding if this is not something you've ever looked at. And then I want to talk a little bit, and Dr. MacArthur got into this a little bit in his talk this morning, how do we as educators deal with the current redefining of our rich past? So there's a certain way as educators that we're teaching our children to define, to understand, to interpret ancient and medieval literature. And that's being completely redefined. And the rug is sort of being pulled out from under our students on the kinds of things that we've been trying to communicate. And so I want to talk about that a little bit. That is actually a picture of me, my freshman year in college. That's definitely what happened to me. And one of the reasons, I'll just tell you on a very personal note, one of the reasons I'm very passionate about this is because all the things that happened to me back in the late 80s are things I'm trying to avoid for my students. That was definitely me when I went to college. I was not ready. I was not prepared to do what Dr. MacArthur described this morning as spiritual warfare in the realm of ideas. So I designed the MLT course at Wilson Hill Academy because of what I call the deer in the headlights experience. I wish I had more time to go into detail on this, but I do want to encourage you, if you have a chance, I promise you, I'm not doing this because my boss is here, and I'm not doing this as a shameless plug, but if you go to our website, we have a blog that I wrote way back as sort of an apologetic, kind of a justification for how and why we would offer a course like this. And I don't even remember the title of the blog, but it should be easy to find. But it has a lot more detail, and I think it might be helpful for those of you who are looking for, well, is this something we'd want to consider at our school? Some of you may be in a situation where you're thinking, I'd love to have this at our school, got to talk the headmaster into it. So those are kinds of things that may be helpful. Deer in the headlights, it's that moment of shock, even paralysis, that you experience when something disturbing happens that you did not see coming. Some of our students are entering into their freshman year of college and they're experiencing this sense of paralysis and shock, and they do not know how to confront it. Our goal should be to make sure that our children do not look like this when they end up at UT or Penn State or the University of Georgia or wherever. Do not experience the shock and paralysis of the deer in the headlights when they go to college. As Christians, we ought to know philosophy just as well as the philosophers. We ought to know Darwinian evolution better than the evolutionists. We should know the arguments for Marxism. Focus a lot on Marxism. Our universities, as you know, are teeming with Marxist professors. Marxism and atheism better than the most eloquent Marxists and atheists. How else can we honor the spirit of 1 Peter 3:15, that is, to sanctify Christ in our hearts and to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is in us? How can we do that? They're confronted with seemingly convincing arguments in favor of these unbiblical worldviews. They do not know how to respond, by and large. They are ill-prepared to defend their faith, much less, and I'm talking about ill-prepared to defend their faith, much less go on the offensive and present the gospel in that environment in a winsome manner. Preparing kids for the real world. So what I'd like you to do at this time is just think of your senior class. Okay? And I want you to try to get a few names in your mind. Billy, Susie, Bobby, whatever. Get some faces in your mind. Get some images. Get some names. And go ahead and get some juniors in there too. Juniors and seniors upcoming. Okay? So just got some names, right? Got some faces in your mind? Okay. I want you to ask yourself, as you're thinking through those names, if Bobby and Susie and Billy, if you think they are truly prepared to deal with, and let me just throw out a few isms that I know you worldview, humanities, philosophy, whatever your course is at your school, teachers, I know you do this every day. Multiculturalism. Nihilism. Do you think Billy's ready to stand up and discuss that intelligently, defend where he is on it? Existentialism. Aestheticism. Queer theory. All the iterations of things related to gender issues. Many, many iterations of feminism. How about critical theory? In a very quick internet search, I don't think that you can find, you might be able to, I didn't, a major university that does not offer courses in queer theory, but also degrees in queer studies. Courses range from the generic, you know, gender studies to specific titles that deal with things like cross-dressing. So they're going from your classical Christian school, whatever that is, and they're going into that environment. The University of Oregon offers an academic minor in queer studies. University of Maryland has an LGBT studies minor. University of North Texas, an LGBT minor. And here's, you know, the thing that may be going through your mind is, I get that. Okay, that's fine. We know that's what they're going into, and we have ways that we're preparing them to do it. Why modern literature? When we have a philosophy course, we have an apologetics course, we have other ways to prepare them. I think there are many other ways that you can do, help your students prepare for these isms. But I think a course in MLT is ideal because they are reading the modern works that, and this is key, that have most directly led to the development and popularity of those views. In other words, you're not just taking your ism and saying, okay, today we're going to talk about multiculturalism. You're reading key works from which that worldview has come down to us and how it has developed over the years. You're not simply or merely discussing feminism. You're reading works of feminist authors and interacting with them. Otherwise, we're simply studying a bunch of isms, but completely detached and outside of any kind of historical, philosophical, cultural context. Where did they come from, and how did they get here? Who are the most, you know, important proponents of those worldviews? So we're not just battling the worldview, but how and where it most recently developed. And that's what we do in an MLT course. In MLT, we're examining these issues in context. We're confronting the worldviews as articulated directly from the pens of advocates and founders of those worldviews, instead of studying them in an isolated sense. Not used to using someone else's technology here. There we go. Last year here at ACCS, I gave a talk on the benefits of studying the works of Fyodor Dostoevsky. In that talk, it was historic. I'm pretty sure there were camera crews, news organizations, crawling all over this place. It was definitely historic because I coined a new term in that talk, a new term that I called the Dostoevsky Principle. The Dostoevsky Principle. And the Dostoevsky Principle, well, let me just kind of explain it this way. I used an illustration called Sparring with Grandma. Is there a picture of Grandma up there? There's a picture of Grandma. And that is not Cortez Martin. Cortez Martin was the meanest, baddest, scariest eighth grader at Central Junior High School where I was attending in seventh grade. He was somewhere around, well, I'm pretty sure he was 6'9", but he was probably more like 5'9", and I was really small. He could dunk the basketball in eighth grade, which is quite a feat. Everybody was scared of Cortez Martin, and I had PE with Cortez Martin, which means I had to go into the boys' locker room and change clothes and get ready for PE and get ready for my next class with Cortez Martin. Cortez Martin threatened little students like me. And so one day, a new student came to school. His name was Jack Lilly. I'll never forget it. Jack Lilly was not a lot bigger than I was, but Jack Lilly was not going to have any of this fear of Cortez Martin that the rest of us had. And so he challenged Cortez Martin to a fight in the boys' locker room, and I saw the fight, and this kid, Jack Lilly, new kid in school, stood up to Cortez Martin. At the end of the fight, there was a lot of scratches and bruises and a lot of blood, and I think it was sort of a draw. And at that point, Cortez and Jack Lilly, I think, became friends after that. I think they've both been in prison a few times, in and out. But I know they're far from me, and that's all that matters. Here's what I took away from that as I thought back upon that experience. Jack Lilly knew, as the new kid in school, that the best way to kind of make his mark and establish himself was to go straight to the toughest dude in the school and beat him up. And that's what he did. From that day on, everybody respected not only Cortez Martin, but they respected Jack Lilly. Because he wasn't going to beat up on some little scrawny kid like me. That wouldn't get him anywhere. That wouldn't get him any respect. But he knew that sparring with Cortez would. What in the world does this have to do with anything we're talking about? I'm concerned that what we do, perhaps unwittingly, perhaps unknowingly, is in some ways, academically, intellectually, we're teaching our students to spar with Grandma instead of to spar with Cortez Martin. So we're setting up some sort of a straw man kind of argument. We read the Communist Manifesto, we rip it to shreds, and then we send them away. And we think they're ready to go deal with some professor at a university level who's going to throw arguments at him that he's just not really familiar with. So I call it the Dostoevsky Principle because that's exactly what Fyodor Dostoevsky does. When he published The Brothers Karamazov, which I'm sure many of you have read and probably teach, in 1880-81-ish, that book contained such a strong case for atheism that some critics actually thought that Dostoevsky was making a case for atheism instead of making a case against it and promoting the Christian worldview. What he did with Ivan, as you know, the atheist character is in that story, is set up the Cortez Martin version of that worldview and then deal with that. So instead of sparring with Grandma, Dostoevsky went to Cortez Martin because he knew if you can take Cortez down, then you can take anything down. Any of you familiar with Jordan Peterson? You guys familiar? Yeah, I would strongly recommend you write that name down, look up a few YouTube videos. You may be interested. He has he's got some weird views when it comes to God and religion. But when it comes to some philosophy and how he approaches and deals with postmodernism and relativism, he has got some great insights. So just a name to throw out there. But Jordan Peterson calls what I'm calling the Dostoevsky principle, or sparring with Cortez instead of grandma, he calls it the Iron Man effect, as opposed to the straw man effect. That is, creating the strongest version of the other side is the best way to prepare our students. As I said earlier, we want to know philosophy as well as the best philosophers and so forth. Evolution, atheism, Marxism, and that takes us right back to 1 Peter chapter 3. It kind of reminds me of a batter, a baseball game. And, there's one guy who's up to bat, but then there's always the other guy who's in the batter's box, and what's he doing? He's getting ready, right? He's swinging a bat, but you know what he's got on the bat, right? He's got some weights on the bat, so he's kind of getting accustomed to swinging a heavier bat. He stands in the batter's box, and he is swinging that bat that has weights on it so that when he swings the bat without the weights, he feels more confident. He feels strong. He feels more like he's in control. And since he's accustomed to swinging the heavier bat, he's going to have a stronger swing. Likewise, we want to train our students like the batter in that batter's box with the heavier weights. What Jordan Peterson calls the Iron Man version of these unbiblical worldviews, so that when they stand up to the plate, they are confident and they're strong in their ability to live out 1 Peter 3:15. What we often do instead is, I'm sure you've heard the expression, knowing enough karate just to get beat up really badly. And I think that, you know a little bit of karate, so you think you can, go out to the streets and beat everybody up. Well, what are you talking about? I mean, we read the Communist Manifesto. We spent 3 class periods talking about it. We debunked all of those views. Karl Marx, what has he got? Why would they not be prepared to walk into that university classroom and take on that Marxist professor? Well, I can tell you that 25 years in education, and I hear back from my students all the time, they're not. They are not ready to deal with that Marxist professor, by and large. They think they can, and that makes the whole situation even a little bit more dangerous. They know just enough karate to get beat up. They have a false sense of preparedness, which, by the way, is actually more dangerous in some cases than not being prepared at all. If they're not prepared at all, then at least they can say, well, you should check out this guy or this guy or this person who can give you good arguments. But they go in there with their gloves on thinking they're ready to do battle, and they're just not. They have a false sense of preparedness. So go back to those names again that you had in your mind earlier and ask yourself, maybe some of you have gotten emails and phone calls like I have from students who've gone off, and I realize, we need to change how we're doing that. I sent one out into the world with a false sense of preparedness. Last thing on my first point, preparing students for a 21st century college experience, we also need to build a healthy respect for individuals and worldviews that we disagree with based on the idea that underestimating your opponent will lead to disaster. So, here's what I think. We need to give our students a healthy and truthful assessment of the other side. Not too much, not too little. But, for example, just keep going back to Marx. Marx was a really smart guy. I mean, in many ways, Marx was a genius. I always cringe when I go to websites and I see memes and I see things that just kind of make him look stupid. Because I think, that's dangerous. You're setting your student up to go get beat up really badly in the world of ideas. Marx was actually a genius in many ways. His Das Kapital is a very serious scholarly attempt to offer insights into economics. And we can't just dismiss him as an idiot and then send our students out there so lightly armed. So we have to consider what the other side says is actually correct. So one of the things, and I'm sure some of you do this in your great books, apologetics, literature classes, a lot of times when I'm introducing a new book, one of the first things I'll do is challenge them and force them to find everything they agree with this author. I don't care if it's Hitler. I do that with Adolf Hitler. We read Mein Kampf. And I ask them, what are some things that you agree with? And after we've done that, then we kind of start working through his worldview and discussing it on a deeper level. But we do have to give our students a healthy respect for the opposing worldviews and individuals we're dealing with. Sending them into a dangerous environment when we don't do that. We can't create the impression that everything the opposing worldview says is just flat wrong. It's a sure recipe for disillusionment. Because once they find out that's not true, then they start wondering, well, what else did Mr. Eder teach me that was off? And then they start wrestling with, well, wait a second. And I've how many of you have gotten this phone call, this email? Mr. Eder, I'm not sure if I'm a Christian anymore. Have you guys gotten that one? I'm glad there aren't any hands up right now, but I've gotten that one. And it's a disturbing communication to get. I don't know if I believe this stuff. I just kind of think I believed it because my parents raised me in a Christian home and I went to a Christian school. Mr. Eder, I'm not really sure about it. So disillusionment sets in. And then that just kind of snowballs. Deer in the headlights. Yeah. All right, let's see. Where are we here? Oh, yeah, I forgot. I had my own new Bruce Eder non-Oxford Dictionary definition of the Dostoevsky Principle, also known as the Cortez-Martin Principle. I'm sure Cortez, sitting in a federal prison right now, would be glad to know that there's a definition named after him. Also often referred to as the Not Sparring with Grandma Principle. It is the practice of arming your students with the ability to effectively respond to non-Christian worldviews by placing before them the most cogent and persuasive expressions of those worldviews and purposefully avoiding weak, strawman expressions of those worldviews. So we've already talked about this. How would that apply? And, I used to have a course where I actually invited members. It was a world religions course, a little different, but not necessarily a bad idea. I invited practicing members of those faiths to come in. So when we're studying Hinduism, I don't want somebody who just is an expert on Hinduism. I want a Hindu. I want a Hindu, and I want somebody who knows it well. And I want them to come in, and I want my students to engage with them. Now, I'll be honest with you. I see. Oh, yeah, I know Ty Fisher's not in here because he's giving a talk right now. I used to work for Ty Fisher at Veritas Academy, and he used to start twitching like this when he would see a Buddhist priest or a Buddhist monk or a Hindu or a Jehovah's Witness come walking down the hall yet the next day to go into Mr. Eder's classroom. And there, some faculty members didn't like that. They didn't think that was a very good idea. But so I guess it's better to just tell them what they believe and then send them out into the world when mommy and daddy and you aren't there to then talk to that Hindu or that Buddhist or that atheist or whatever. That doesn't make any sense to me. I want them face to face with that person right now while I still have some impact and some presence and some influence in their lives. I want to interact with someone who embraces different iterations of feminism and socialism and atheism, because that's what they're going to run into. There's the passage we're focusing on. Okay. All righty. We do it on time here. 24. Okay. Point number two. Another way that MLT fits into our classical education model is that modern literature looks back and is connected to the classical world. Now, I'm going to have to make a confession here. I didn't realize to what extent this was true until I started preparing for and teaching the modern lit course. I didn't realize this. This is going to be where you have these juniors and seniors in this modern lit course, and all that they have been learning in those ancient lit and medieval lit courses is all going to come to fruition now, because there are so many purposeful connections made by the authors that we study. Let's start with James Joyce. There are a few works that I think you could go with James Joyce, but I think Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man is the best one. I do have a class period where I talk about Ulysses and I explain to them what is the incomprehensible labyrinth that is Ulysses, but I wouldn't recommend trying to tackle Ulysses. First of all, you just won't have time. I mean, Ulysses is a year-long course in itself. But anyway, we do Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. It is a modern retelling, and this is what's key, reinterpretation of the ancient Daedalus myth. You know, the myth of the ultimate craftsman, the artisan who made wings to escape from the labyrinth. Joyce is saying that there's a new way that we should understand the ancient myth. And he uses the old story to promote his worldview, which, you know, James Joyce was raised in a very hardcore, very serious Irish Roman Catholic home, and then very vehemently threw all of that out the window, mocked it, and became an artist. And the Portrait of the Artist is really autobiographical. But he is promoting his particular, the ism that we discuss with Joyce is aestheticism. The same is true with Ulysses. What Joyce is doing with Ulysses is he's using the basic outline and travels of Odysseus, the ancient Greek warrior. But what's he doing with Odysseus? He is reinterpreting the meaning of the ancient story. So for James Joyce, the Odyssey takes on new meaning as it provides archetypes of modern man's dilemma. Let me say that again. The Odyssey now, so this Odyssey, this precious, beautiful, how many of you love the Odyssey? Come on, if anybody has their hands down, you're sleeping. We all love the Odyssey, right? It's core to what what he's doing with the Odyssey is giving it new meaning as it provides archetypes of modern man's dilemma. So what Joyce is doing is he's taking something that is very special and very precious and very central in our ancient lit courses, and he's saying it doesn't mean what those teachers at blank, blank classical Christian school told you it means. It doesn't mean that. Let me tell you how you can really better understand the Odyssey. So when you're, I want to capture that in high school. I want to capture that in high school. And I'm going to give you an example from a student I just heard from a week ago that's going to highlight why that's important. Okay. One of my favorite authors is Virginia Woolf, who, by the way, how many of you knew that Virginia Woolf carried a copy of the Odyssey with her frequently when she traveled? It was her work. It was what it motivated her. It challenged her. She reread it over and over and over. Again, what is Virginia Woolf doing? So there's a lot of things you could read by Virginia Woolf. We read To the Lighthouse. That's the one that I chose. You could certainly read several other works, but To the Lighthouse is a little more popular, and it also reinterprets the ancient story. And that's important. She's reinterpreting the ancient story. To the Lighthouse is essentially a modern feminist epic. She's basically saying, okay, back in the old days when men ruled the world, this is what an epic looked like. But things are different now. And let me tell you how things are going to be different, because of feminism. It is essentially a modern feminist epic with allusions all over the place to Homer. She is launching from Homer in an effort to show us how Homer, once again, should be interpreted and understood today. That's important. I want to talk to my students about that. I don't want Virginia Woolf telling them how they should understand and interpret Homer. William Faulkner. Again, three or four works that you could probably go with. Sound and the Fury. I'm sorry if there are any big fans here. I've read that book so many times and I can't stand it. I do As I Lay Dying for William Faulkner. As I Lay Dying is a lot more accessible. It connects back to Joyce because the voices are Joycean voices. And the title of the book itself comes from a scene, you guessed it, in Homer. This is when Agamemnon is in Hades after he's been murdered by his wife Clytemnestra, and he's describing what happened and so forth, As I Lay Dying. So the title comes directly from Homer, and Faulkner, again, is giving us his version of how ancient myths are to be understood now in the modern world. Well, any Flannery O'Connor fans here? Oh, man, everybody just woke up. Oh, my goodness. I'm teaching a course this summer. I am so excited that my boss is letting me teach a course this summer on the works of Flannery O'Connor for the first time. Flannery O'Connor is it's not the only one. It's one of our Christian responses to the other works. And she fits, not only because of when she wrote, but because she is very deliberately, I know some of you are thinking, Bruce, I've read her stories and it's just about a bunch of tattooed freaks and weirdos and violence, and why would you expose a kid to that? I know it seems like that on the surface, and wise blood, oh my goodness. But O'Connor is, one time she said something like, and for you O'Connor, you know, aficionados, I'll get the exact wording wrong, but she basically said, for the blind, you have to write in really large letters, you know. So, in other words, she was trying to shock a generation on purpose. This sweet, young, seemingly innocent, southern girl, Milledgeville, who writes these stories that you would think came from someone like Stephen King. But she was sharing the gospel. And she was trying to shock a generation into seeing the implications of the exact worldviews that we deal with. She addresses Joyce. Where? She does. She addresses Camus. She addresses existentialism. So she's dealing with that. So O'Connor is a part of our Christian response in the course. But interestingly, we read Wise Blood. Anybody familiar with Wise Blood? Okay, a few of you. Okay. She was, I don't know if you knew this, but Flannery O'Connor was really good friends with Sally and Robert Fitzgerald. And if those names sound kind of familiar to you, go back and look at all your copies of everything translated from Greek, and you probably have some Robert Fitzgerald translations. We used to use his Aeneid, his Oedipus, and so forth. So he's a 20th century scholar, Greek scholar, translator, and he translated a lot of the works that you're probably using in your schools. But anyway, Flannery O'Connor was good friends with the Fitzgeralds, and she was living with them while she was writing Wise Blood. And Robert Fitzgerald was actually working on, you guessed it, translating Oedipus while she was living with them. Now, reading Wise Blood and thinking of that should pretty much blow your mind, because she denies it in Habit of Being. She says in Habit of Being, that's her letters, her book of letters are collected by Sally Fitzgerald. But how in the world can Wise Blood not be a modern retelling of the Oedipus story? I mean, it just is, even if she didn't intend it to be. It clearly is. Well, I could go on and on. We do T.S. Eliot. I'll be honest with you. At the end of the year, I ask my students what their favorite books were, least favorite and favorites. I am shocked. both years we've done it, at how many T.S. Eliot? I assumed, wrongly, I assumed that he would be inaccessible. I assumed that T.S. Eliot would just do this, that I would not be able to get high school students to get into T.S. Eliot. And I have students sharing quotes from four quartets in our final class of the year, is kind of a goodbye class, weeping while they're reading passages from The Wasteland and four quartets. What in the world is that all about? I assumed that there's no way. Well, T.S. Eliot really does the same thing, but T.S. Eliot touches every time period in every culture, east and west, north and south. And that's important. That's very important. Studying ancient and medieval literature and not dealing with the modern voices. This is actually the point I'm making with all this. Which, not dealing with the modern voices that are telling us how we should understand those ancient myths, is like, I know you thought I lost my mind with that Bermuda story, didn't you? Yeah, I had a point to that. It's like my trip to Bermuda. You know, you travel all that distance, you make all these plans, you go there for a purpose, and then you don't even get to walk on the beach. You stay in the bed in the hotel room the whole week. To me, what I've concluded now after the few years that we've been working on this project is that there is a parallel between those two things. Not focusing, and I'm not talking about just having a great books course that ends with a few, you know, works in the 20th century. I'm talking about a course that focuses on post-World War I. So you start with World War I and go from there. And it zeroes in more intensely on this time period and on the literature that comes from it. It's like not going to the beach at Bermuda. You work through the ancient and medieval literature, at least in part, so that you can interact with how we should understand this rich literature today, but then you stop short. It's like getting off two stops too early on a train, you know? We need to make it to the end of the line, and that's a part of what the MLT course is all about. Pretty good on time so far. So that brings us to my final point here. Tying together the first two points, the current redefining of our rich past. Modern man has taken our rich literary past and redefined it. We're sending our kids away without realizing that 21st century educators are operating in a very different, with a very different basic understanding of the value of the ancients. My passion about giving this talk today was confirmed when I spoke with one of my former students just a week ago, 2 weeks ago maybe. She's a sophomore now at a university in Virginia. And she explained to me how she was in this literature course this past year, and she called me up just bubbling over with excitement. And she says, "Mr. Etter, I took this course, and it was just completely permeated with reader response theory." But she was saddened by the fact that none of the other students in the class knew that. None of the other students in the class knew that. So she's looking around while the professor is saying this. This is what the professor told her, told the class. "You are not allowed to research or look up any biographical information on the authors we're reading. You are not allowed to look up any historical, cultural, philosophical background on any of the works we're reading." What is that professor trying to get those students to do? Read the text and do what? Reader response theory. It's whatever you make it to be. We're going to read the story, and the story means whatever you want it to mean. And we'll all share our different responses to the text. And they weren't even allowed. But Isabel, my student, she said, "I knew exactly what was going on. I knew exactly what was happening, but it was depressing and sad because I couldn't raise my hand and say, You can't study literature that way. That's a part of critical theory. That's one of the categories of critical theory, reader response. No, because we do what I call a biographical historical approach. But interestingly, she's a really sharp girl. So I said to her, "Oh, Isabel, you would have recognized that anyway." And she said, "Mr. Editor, no way. I would not have seen clearly what was going on in that class." We spend a whole unit at the beginning of MLT on critical theory. They read the book. I think her name is Lois Tyson. But the book's just called Critical Theory. It's not written by a believer, but it's a very good book, and it explains all the different categories. We do a whole unit on critical theory before we even dive into Joyce, because then when we're reading the other works, they can do exactly what Isabel did in her sophomore literature class in college. Recognize what is the agenda of this author. How do I identify it? How do I deal with it? How do I confront it? In conclusion, we are where we are today, 2018, is really a more direct result of post-World War I literature. And often we ask and we seek answers to the question, how did we get here? And I think we're doing a great job at doing, you know, what I might call the Francis Schaeffer thing and looking at the really, really big picture and seeing the flow of events, you know, blaming it all on Thomas Aquinas, you know, all that with Francis Schaeffer. And we're doing a good job of seeing that big picture. But what we're not doing is zeroing in more intensely on what has happened in the last 100 years. I think we're missing that gap. And a course focusing exclusively on that gap is worthwhile. So as I said earlier, I think that's all I got. Oh, well, let me just run through my slides. If I'm going to come all the way to Texas, I'm going to make it through my slides. All right, I can't. So this is just one of the visuals that we use at the beginning of the year when we're doing critical theory. So they read a chapter on each of these in that book. And I think what the author does is, I think she takes the Great Gatsby and walks through, I'm seeing some nods, some of you use that book maybe. I think she takes the Great Gatsby and then walks through the Great Gatsby in each chapter and says, okay, if I'm looking at this from a feminist critical theory perspective, what would the Great Gatsby look like? How would I understand the Great Gatsby from a structuralism perspective, from the new historicism approach, from psychoanalytic theory? We do a little bit of Freud and Jung. And from lesbian, gay, queer theory, you know, everybody's gay in the story. Of course, that's obvious. You're just not looking for the right clues. But again, how do our students identify that? They're 17. They're 18. We're doing a really good job at teaching them how to think. I really are. They are light years ahead of where I was when I was that age. But I don't think they're fully ready in ways that they could be. Anyway, as I said earlier, graduates are entering universities and experiencing the dreaded deer in the headlights syndrome. And I hope that you'll consider a heavy dose of Joyce and Kafka and Wolfe and Faulkner and queer theory to the curriculum. So thank you for coming. I do want to just mention, some of you came in late. This is a t-shirt that the students in the course designed. And if you'd like to come by the Wilson Hill Academy booth and try to guess, can some of you name a few of those already? Can you see a few 20th century works that you think are represented there? Some of them are a little tricky. Yeah. I'll give you a hint. The sun is not The Sun Also Rises. That one's actually Camus, The Stranger. Anyway, if you'd like to come by, I have been given authorization to give away something very special. Right, Nancy? At the Wilson Hill Academy booth. A little bit of Wilson Hill Academy merch. And I'd love to just come and chat with you about what you're doing. We're an online school, so I taught in brick-and-mortar classical schools for a long time and then got into online teaching, and I just love hearing stories about what you're doing and in some cases maybe how we can even help you with what you're doing so. I think, look at that. I gave you 5 minutes to go get a drink of water. So thank you for coming today, friends. Appreciate it.